Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about creeps and the creeps who hunt them.
I want you to tell me why you sent that stuff to us.
I made a terrible choice.
Okay, why don't you tell me about it?
Terrible choice.
Wait for that. One of the causes of the spread of such diseases as cancer and tuberculosis is homosexuality. Health laws of former civilizations were made to prevent such diseases, and homosexuals were not tolerated. They were put to death. In Germany today, some of the leaders wish similar laws to be passed. Surely it is up to women in modern times to unite to remedy such social evils as this. That was published in the Montreal Star, a newspaper that does not exist anymore. Those words ran in their September 2nd, 1937 edition. It's wild to read old newspapers and get a sense on what were the topics that everybody seemed to agree about at different times. Any era that you look back at, there were always a few things that everybody agreed were wrong. Evil, even. Those things often had to do with sex. Homosexuality, pornography, prostitution, interracial sex. Nobody was really debating them at certain times. Mainstream discourse seemed to agree that these were just bad things that should be stopped. So the debate that you read about in old newspaper archives was about how to stop these things, with execution on the table as a reasonable option to contemplate. Reading that old newspaper copy now is, well, it's a good way to feel like maybe we have made some progress. It's not just that society used to hate queer people, and now we mostly don't. It's that we've had a rethink on the entire notion that a person's sexual orientation is a moral choice that they've made. People don't get to choose what kind of sex they want. Morality lies in how we act on our sexual desires, or how we don't. Not everybody agrees with that, but most people these days, myself included, consider that to not just be true, but also to be the enlightened, inclusive, progressive way that we should all think about human sexuality. However, we have an exception to that. Most people, myself included, have an exception to that inclusive and progressive rule about human sexuality, because there is still one form of human sexual orientation that we perceive as just plain wrong. Evil, even. It is not okay to desire sex with children. If every society has its own idea of a pure evil, of a non-negotiable, this is ours. Pedophilia is our moral absolute. There is not a lot of openness to debate or exploration or nuance on the topic. Distinctions between wanting sex with children and having sex with children, or the difference between a child who is 17 and a child who is 7, or the difference between possessing child porn and producing child porn. Well, a judge may have to take that kind of stuff into consideration when they're sentencing someone, but we don't really want to talk about it in public discourse. The whole category of pedophilia is painted with a bright red scarlet letter. You do not want to be seen splitting hairs. You don't want to risk rationalizing or justifying it. You don't want people wondering why you're talking about it. And let me be very clear. I don't want to be devil's advocating any of this stuff either. I have zero interest in some kind of thought experiment where we rebelliously dare to equivocate or split hairs on the topic. I am A-okay with all things under the category of pedo being painted with that bright red scarlet letter. Maybe, some things are not just subjective. They're not malleable social mores that we'll all have a laugh at in time. Maybe there is such thing as a moral absolute. And I'm okay with this being one of them. The problem, and there is a problem, is that moral absolutes are dangerous. Because when you're fighting pure evil, anything goes. Today's episode is about a person who told the world that he was doing just that, fighting monsters. But as you'll hear, when Jason Nasser went out hunting creeps, innocent people died.
My brother, first and foremost, was a good person. He was very bright. He was educated. And he was autistic. And I think had he not met the creeper hunter, I think he would still be alive today.
Jason Nasser was an internet creeper hunter, and he sat down with filmmakers for interviews. He is the subject of a new documentary called Shamed, and the director and the producer of Shamed will join me in studio in a moment. Wait for it.
My name is Matt Gallagher, and I'm a documentary director.
I'm Cornelia Principe, and I'm a producer, and the producer of the documentary Shamed.
It was a packed theater down at the Bloor Theater, and, you know, the film starts, and it's a 90-minute film, and about 15 minutes in, there's a reveal that one of these men who was accused of being a child predator died by suicide, and we just heard this. And there was a clap.
Mm-hmm.
There was a clap. And I was just like, I mean, we finished this film 1 week ago. So this is the first time we're showing this film to an audience. And I had no idea that somebody in the audience would cheer for the death of someone. It was a little frightening and a little scary because I knew that there were points in the film where there was going to be more reveals of other suicides and other deaths. And I just thought to myself, is this person, this anonymous person in the audience, going to clap at every one of those? And what made it worse is that the families of those dead men were in the audience with that clapper.
Who is Jason Nasser, and why did he start hunting creeps, Matt?
He's a fellow Windsorite. Both Jason and I are from Windsor, Ontario. I know him to be this guy who has run a vigilante website for about 5 years.
When I first started working with creeper hunters, I saw it really as hunting. The idea of hunting is that there's a vulnerable person or a vulnerable entity, and another entity sees itself as higher in status, perhaps, and then there needs to be some kind of equilibrium.
And in doing that, he basically went after people that he believed were child predators or pedophiles, and he confronted them online, and he confronted them with a camera and then posted these little videos online.
He did like a homemade version of, what was it, To Catch a Predator? There was like a network TV show that used to do this.
Yeah, so that's Chris Hansen, and that's NBC, and that's To Catch a Predator. That show was very successful. It ran for a number of years until, of course, there was a suicide that was actually filmed on camera, and so that changed everything, and that show got canceled. But that show kind of spawned a lot of these copycat guys like Jason Nasser to start doing the same thing, but with less rules, I guess.
A suicide of one of the alleged child predators.
Correct.
As you say, there's like this like culture of online creep catchers that Nasser was a part of. Networks of vigilantes, were they doing this
for views? Were they doing this as entertainment?
I mean, at some point in the 5 years that Jason was doing this, he had upwards of 200,000 subscribers, and these videos were garnering sometimes 800,000 views.
He had a community that was egging him on or giving him the thumbs up, that were basically seeing him as a hero who's protecting children. And that got obviously morphed and twisted into kind of a darker thing. And I think that that's probably the case with a lot of these groups.
I think that the kind of head scratch, what would motivate somebody to do this? Was it for money, or did he think he was right? Once you bring in hundreds of thousands of followers applauding what you're doing and encouraging you and telling you that you're doing something great, it's almost like there's a new motive when we're talking about why people do things.
Yeah.
You can call it clout, but I just think it's a hell of a drug.
I'm sure a lot of them started with a genuinely wanting to protect children, but by posting it online and shaming people, there is certainly a public entertainment aspect to it. But with Jason, it started sort of by accident. He was in a mall somewhere in Ontario, and he noticed a guy taking video of girls or women up their skirts.
Uh-huh.
And he videotaped this guy doing that video, and then he confronted him on camera in the parking lot saying, you were taking that sort of thing. So he posted it on his social media, and he got all these people saying, good for you, you're a hero, you're blah, blah. And that's, I think, when the light went off. And uh-huh. He thought, huh, I could turn this into something more.
And it was called Creep Hunter TV, so very sensationalistic. And
absolutely, yeah.
This is a show. This is TV. This
absolutely.
I'm hunting and you can watch me.
Why don't you tell me why you invited a 14-year-old boy here? Yeah, you did.
Hold on, I got the chat log right here. Do you want to talk? Stop right now.
Sir?
Stop right now, or I'm going to be forced to arrest
even...
you. Why are you playing bull with me?
One thing that I read when I was trying to familiarize myself with this world of online creep catchers is that a lot of them have criminal records themselves. Hmm. They're out there as vigilantes, but they have been criminals. They have criminal records. What are we to make of that?
I think that's interesting because one of our subjects says it in the film. They found a way to be celebrated by their criminality by doing something online, especially accusing people of being a pedophile. It's kind of bulletproof because who's going to stand up for these people? Because then it suggests that you're approving of pedophilia, which is crazy, of course. So really, they found this way of getting around the law to some extent. Doxing is not illegal, technically.
Impersonating a 12-year-old girl is not illegal.
No, impersonating a 12-year-old girl is not
really. Not illegal.
No, none of that's illegal.
So videotaping somebody, that's actually not illegal unto itself. The laws, I mean, this is good for journalism. You don't have to have somebody's permission to videotape them in a public place.
So if you wear the hat of the journalist or the educator and you're calling someone a pedophile, you really, most people will just look the other way unless they like this kind of, and it's sort of a blood sport to some extent.
Uh-huh.
So when we went into making this documentary, we had a lot of conflict and discussions around, obviously, when I first heard about it from Matt and he started talking to me about it, I was like, I don't want to go there. I don't even want to watch these videos. It's awful. And to weave the story in a way that we're not saying pedophilia is good. Child predators are good. Obviously, that's not the case. The question is this the way to catch them? Is this the way to protect children? And obviously not. And I think with a lot of predator hunters, that may have been the initial idea, but ultimately the enjoyment of it, the entertainment of it, the likes, maybe in some cases the money, has taken over to some extent.
I think a lot of people would agree that this is about as heinous a crime as somebody can commit. And people who have been preyed upon as children can live with trauma their entire lives and can feel like nobody gave a and that the law didn't really care or have many tools to deal with it and that people turned a blind eye. And so I think that part of what allows this creep culture thing to flourish and why people applaud them and why Jason was not repentant or apologetic at all is this conception that what they're doing is very good. Somebody's got to do something about this. And if the law can't lock up these people, then exposing them on the internet is a public good.
You put it very well, but those are things that Corneli and I and our editor Nick Hector really wrestled with for 2 years. You know, why do we give a shit? And I think I've come up with sort of why we should give a shit is because after talking to the families, hearing how he did it and what he did to them, and sort
the families of the men who he accused.
Yeah, the families of the men who he accused and the families of the men who took their own lives by suicide or died by drug overdose shortly after their contact with Jason.
And how many men did that?
In our film, we have five, but I know of more that we just couldn't explore yet. Like, there are 100 videos on that website that no longer exists. There are many, many other stories that we haven't even researched yet, but there's a lot of, you know, collateral damage out there.
There's this one scene in your documentary that you shot in Iowa. I'd like you to take us through that, and just so our listeners can follow what's happening here, you refer to the target who Jason is following as John Doe.
So we're in Iowa. We're in a parking lot of a lab, a forensics lab, that had just taken the cell phone of John Doe and was able to crack it and get into all the text messages that were being sent to John Doe on the day of his death. And there was a lot. There were people texting this person because Jason had posted this man's personal information online so they could phone him, text him. They knew the wife's name, the whole deal. And so this man was getting these texts, and what was revealed on the cell phone was a text that was taunting him, basically calling him horrible names. And what we could tell from the text is that it happened on the day that he died, the day that he killed himself, or the day that he died by suicide in his garage. And so as we're reading these texts, I asked the FBI officer, the retired FBI officer, to call the number because I know it's a 905 number, so I know it's a Canadian number. I know it's not Jason Nasser's number, but we call, and a man answers.
Hello.
Hi, my name's Brian, and I was looking to talk to the owner of the phone.
And the FBI officer explains who he is and asks if this was indeed the messages that this man, this unknown caller, sent, and he says yes. And then the FBI officer reveals that the man actually died moments after this text was sent.
So shortly after this text was made to the John Doe here in Iowa, he took his own life.
I don't care about that, man, and I don't feel sorry for him.
And instead of the caller hanging up or expressing some kind of concern or remorse, he celebrates it.
This kind of was the final straw that led to his death.
This is the one, eh?
This is the one.
Wow, and then he killed himself after this one?
Yep.
Awesome. Wow, that's cool.
For me, sitting in the back seat of that vehicle filming this, it was chilling.
Yeah, I hear you, but you know that there are people who are not going to find that chilling or even upsetting. That there are other people out there who would cheer or celebrate that as well.
Why should we care if it's one more dead predator? Hooray. But first of all, these men were never charged or convicted of being a child predator. They never did anything.
That we know of.
That we know of. And also, is that the kind of world that we want, where we can just call someone something and they have to live with that for the rest of the world? Extrapolate further even, where does this end? I mean, with AI, you can start putting words in people's mouths, and it's an extension of it. I think you could take this example and look at other things that are happening in the world. Like, for example, I don't know if this is a stretch, but Trump just sent how many hundreds of Venezuelans to a prison because they are all gang members. Well, great. Gang members should be locked up for life. Well, some of them aren't gang members. They just happen to have a tattoo that maybe looks like a gang member tattoo. The question is, do we want a system that is fair for all, or do we want a system where justice or punishment, and when people actually, to the extent where they would commit suicide, is that the kind of world we want? Do we want a world where mob rules and we make the decisions based on completely inaccurate information?
You've got this spectrum. On the far end of the spectrum, you surprised me in finding somebody who I actually think might be totally blameless.
My brother, first and foremost, was a good person. He was very bright, he was educated, and he was autistic. He faced the gamut of challenges and stereotypes that are placed upon people with disabilities, and he overcame every single one of them. And I think had he not met the Creeper Hunter, I think he would still be alive today.
There's a credible argument made by brother of one of the John Does, who said, my late brother was a beautiful person and a worthwhile and moral person who was autistic and who was trying to make connections with people and put out 1,000 messages on Plenty of Fish to grown-ups looking for romance. And one of the people who responded initially presented as an adult and then at some point said, oh, by the way, I'm 15, and then said, let's get together for ice cream. And guess what? My autistic brother was showing up to have ice cream.
Yeah.
My brother genuinely thought that he was meeting up with a 15-year-old. He'd never expressing anything sexual in the chats whatsoever.
And his autistic brother was 23.
Yeah.
He wasn't like a 45-year-old man. And he was showing up to McDonald's for ice cream.
Pauline is not coming. Pauline is not a real person.
There wasn't a 15-year-old there. It was the Creeper Hunter with a camera.
This is for my YouTube channel.
The Creeper Hunter stuck a camera in my brother's face and interrogated him.
After Jason Nasser posted the video exposing this autistic John Doe as an alleged child predator, what happened to him?
So after he was exposed in the video, his life just took a huge turn. He had to drop out of school. He kept losing jobs. He was confronted again by Jason on the street once. And it was a downward spiral. He started doing drugs, so self-destructive behavior, and he eventually died of a drug overdose that the whole family believes was self-induced drug overdose. But there's, you know, it's not officially a suicide, but it was a drug overdose. And that's the case, I think, with all the other men who died of a drug overdose, that there was this sense that their world came crashing in and drugs became their escape and their ultimate escape in the end when they died.
So that feels like a bit of an outlier, and outliers are why the justice system is as rigorous as it is for innocent until proven guilty, because you don't want to lock up innocent people. But aside from those outliers, you made me think about this. Are these thought crimes? Some of these people haven't done anything. They were engaged in an online conversation. They weren't even online with a minor. Maybe they thought they were, or maybe they didn't care. They thought, okay, we're both role-playing. And then they showed up, and we don't know what would have happened next, or if they've ever done anything before.
Exactly. I think this, the thought crime, I thought was a really good idea, really good concept, because I think, in a sense, people online are role-playing to start with. So everybody, to some extent, is role-playing. The difference between online and reality can be quite vast. I suspect some of these men obviously did questionable things, but I think about if you were defined by your worst thought, how would that feel? So some of these men showed up. Some of them maybe thought that the 19-year-old was role-playing as a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to point out, and we interviewed a couple of cops, and they said there's a very big difference between someone talking to a 15-year-old and talking to a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
It's a big difference.
Yeah. Once you've got this kind of like moral absolute of pedophile,
yeah,
people don't really want to split hairs. A pedophile is,
yeah,
a pedophile. But there's a big difference. We have to accept that one thing, there's a hypocrisy in a culture that simultaneously casts pedophiles as like the lowest of the low, that any kind of sexual thing to minors is just absolute morally abhorrent, while simultaneously sexualizing adolescents constantly.
Totally.
So a 5-year-old is not a 15-year-old.
Totally. I mean, there's like all these porn sites called Barely Legal. And that's okay. Like,
yeah.
So, you know.
I think this is worth exploring, too. On the one hand, I can understand your reluctance to delve into this, and it takes years to make a film like this and to spend that much time on this topic. It's dark, and it's a hard place to put your consciousness for so long, and it feels kind of fringe. And yet, there are all these pedo allegations these days. Like the allegation that this one's a pedophile and my political opponent is a pedophile and the Democrats are a bunch of pedophiles. Like, it's like everybody's calling each other a pedophile all of a sudden. Why has this popped in the culture where everybody's enemy is a pedophile, it seems?
Because there's no coming back from that. You can call someone a pedophile. I mean, you'd be better to call someone racist than a pedophile, because everybody hates pedophiles.
Yeah, actually,
there's no retort. What do you say? No, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting that it's very much associated with prison culture where, you know, people are convicted thieves and murderers and rapists, but who does everybody agree is the lowest of the low? In Canada, they're called goofs, and there's no greater insult than to call somebody a goof.
Do you know, Jesse, that I didn't know that that's what a goof was. And the reason I bring that up is because one of my last contacts with Jason was online, and I had already done many interviews with him. And I think by that point, he had sort of seen that the documentary wasn't going to go the way he thought it was going to go.
Uh-huh.
And he called me a goof. And I was just like, oh, that's I've heard the term goof before, but I didn't realize that's what it meant.
I noticed that, too, in reading up on these guys, is that when they get confronted, they accuse the people who are challenging them of being child predators. Like, right. It's sort of their go-to. That is a unique bit of Canadian prison culture. It feels like such a silly, like, grade school insult. Ah, you goof, get out of here. Right. But you don't want to call somebody in the wrong bar a goof, because they will defend their honor against that.
That's good to know, Jesse. Thanks.
You knew. One of the twists in the documentary comes when you introduce us to a young woman named Jocelyn.
My first photo shoot with Jason, we had set it up to happen at Willowstead Park. We came here because I wasn't comfortable taking the photos he wanted to, so I thought this would be a good alternative.
We meet this young woman in your film who accuses him of posting revenge porn. She was a model, and he was the photographer. She was younger than him, and she felt coerced into posing for explicit photographs that he then allegedly posted online in retribution, and she's not the only one who accuses him of this.
He posted the nudes that we had discussed were not going to be used on my Facebook. It was humiliating.
Is this a big defense of his? This guy who's essentially been accused of sexual abuse, finding sexual abusers or people who he considers sexual abusers to expose himself online.
I kept on hearing stories about Jason Nasser when he worked as a photographer, and he would, in Jocelyn's case, Jocelyn was on a dating website as an 18 or 19-year-old young woman, and Jason Nasser, the photographer, reached out, I'm paraphrasing here, but said, "Hi, I'm a photographer. I'm not interested in dating, but you're very beautiful, and I'd like to take pictures of you." And so they arranged to meet, and then that relationship quickly became intimate, and Jason took very intimate photos, very graphic photos of her. And when the relationship didn't work out, Jason posted these images online. And not only did he post these very graphic images of her online with her full legal name, he posted the consent form that was signed by her as an 18-year-old saying she consents to these photos.
Uh-huh.
On the same webpage. It was horrible. And that's not the only woman we talked to. We spoke to another woman from Minnesota who had the same experience.
But he also sent these photos to her family through Facebook.
Oh, God.
So, and this was all happening just before he started Creeper Hunter around that same time. So I think he was starting to realize a way that he could use the internet for his own purposes. And if you, when you're watching the film, he clearly is having fun with his job. He's clearly enjoying it in the videos.
I love producing. You know, you can't write stuff like this. Personally speaking, I get enjoyment out of the production. Seeing good camera shots, good lighting, good audio, all that stuff, it makes me pants.
And just to be clear here, you know, these allegations of him posting revenge porn, that allegedly happened before he started Creeper Hunter TV. So then fast forward, and he's got his YouTube channel. He's a creep who hunts creeps or who hunted creeps, and ultimately the law catches up with him, and he is charged. What was he charged with, and what was the outcome?
Originally, he was charged with criminal negligence causing death, extortion, harassment by communications, and creating and distributing written child pornography.
The extortion charge, was that in relation to give me money and I'll take down this video of you?
No. In Nasser's videos, he has this line that he uses all the time. Once he confronts these individuals in the parking lots, he says, "You better talk to me or I'm going to call the police." He's basically saying, "You need to do this or I'm going to do that."
He flies to a new city in order to film these confrontations when he finally can get one of these guys to come to a mall parking lot or something. And if they just drive away without ever showing their face, he doesn't have much of a video. So the way that he tricks them into actually appearing in these videos, which is sort of like the money shot of these things, is the guy standing there facing these allegations, and what's he going to say for himself? Is it a lie? If you run away, I'll call the cops. Does he call the cops when they...
The last thing Nasser would ever do was call the cops. He doesn't want to deal with the cops. He doesn't want to deal with the courts. He doesn't want to spend time...